This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully, everybody's been doing well. I have been off for the week. I have not been doing any client work. I've been actually working on my own property, and it's really been fruitful. I've got my pond all done. I finished that just the other day. A close friend of mine, we worked together in building that pond. So what I try to do on my property, and I would suggest this for a lot of properties, when you have marginal conditions where you experience drought, you know, wherever you are in the U.S., it's important to have water resources near and adjacent to food plots. And not necessarily for wildlife purposes, although there's a wildlife benefit likely, but to improve the hydrology in and around those areas. And one thing that I do, and I've mentioned this, I think, often on the podcast, is using those water resources for food plots or farming or et cetera, like trees. And the way these are set up is they're no more or less than 100 feet from a related food plot. So kind of in that range. I run a trash pump, a small Honda pump. I think it's, I don't remember the model, but it's really small. It's like an X10 or X20. It's relatively small. Forgive me if I've got the model number wrong, but it's easy to transport. And then I run 100 or 200 foot hose. I think it's about 100 foot hose, like a fireman's hose, out into a sprinkler system. And that sprinkler system I can use to water pretty much anything that's in the adjacent area. Now, that being said, you know, I think there's a lot of focus on water holes. And over the years, I've learned one important, I think, topic is go big or go home. If a water source is 100 gallons or 300 gallons or 400 gallons, that's meaningless in an animal's life. It's meaningless in fixing the hydrology. It's meaningless in collecting water as a resource. It is absolutely meaningless. And what I've learned is if you go bigger as like space, you know, allows or you know, the water resources allowed, you're going to get a bigger return. And one of the focus points is actually hydrating an area to create water nutrient-rich plants. And that is a more of attraction, that is a higher level of attraction than the water resource itself, particularly for deer. And then if you increase the sodium levels or the related mineral content in and around those areas, you will have interest all year long. And that's a huge piece of this. The other piece is trying to eliminate hardware. So in this pond that I built, unfortunately, I have silty, gravelly, loamy soil, which is great soil to have. But it infiltrates really easily. So I have no clay in those particular areas. And without clay, I had to put in a liner and geotextile above it. And then I didn't end up putting just around the edges, I put dirt, but I didn't fill anything else in with dirt. I'll do that over time if I feel like that's appropriate. But the bottom line is, what you're trying to achieve in these areas is increasing the water load and increasing the hydrology higher and adjacent to our food resources for deer. And again, that's really the objective. An animal using that water resource as a place to get a drink, that's great. You know, I'm exceptionally fond of that. But it really serves a bigger purpose of holding water high in the landscape and letting that water basically infiltrate and eventually, you know, seep down the landscape and benefit the adjacent plants. And that will be more useful for you than actually spending time with a tote. I ripped all my totes out. I don't have any totes. I do have small water holes and depressions. Those are for my daughter catching frogs, but I got to clean them out every year. And if anybody's willing to go in and clean those out every year, flush them with new water, spend time just managing them, then by all means, go ahead and do it. But I think you're wasting your time. In fact, I think it's not worth your time. In fact, I would recommend anybody who listens to this podcast, if it's not over, then if the water source is not cannot hold greater than 2 to 10,000 gallons, I wouldn't even consider it at this point. And that comes from somebody who's actually gone through the mistakes, you know, basically wasted time, and it's just not worth it. If you have really clean water, the other thing is making sure you have clean water. A lot of the water resources that we're using are polluted. So this is really cool. So I have, and again, this is just the, you know, the benefit of buying a property with water. I have a stream. It's a non-classified stream. So there's no record of this particular stream, but it's a natural resource. So it produces, water right out of the ground. It's a natural spring. And then there's a collection point where I'm taking that water through a drive pipe, so basically PVC pipe, into this ram pump. And this ram pump is pushing the water based on the movement of air and water in a check valve. And there's a bladder, and it creates pressure, and it basically shoots it out like a fire hose. Well, there's enough pressure in the system to actually elevate and push water all the way up 140 feet into this pond. So I'm taking water from 140 foot below this pond and putting it way up on the hillside. And it's an engineering feat, and it took a while to get it all dialed in. And I've mentioned it on the podcast previously what I was doing. But the idea is to leverage clean water in these areas. Having dirty water or having to add additives, I think of the product EHD Defense. I've heard it multiple times. I'm not saying the product's good or bad. I'm just mentioning that you have to include additives because you have poor water resources. I would be inclined to not to have any water resources or enrich those water resources, create buffers, you know, the correct aquatic plants to clean those. I don't have any fish. Fortunately, I feel like this is a good thing, although I've been going back and forth on this because I want fish in these areas because I think it'd be super cool. But you'll see how crystal clear my water is. You can drink right out of these streams. And that's the beauty of buying a property with really, you know, high valued water resources. And that's kind of what I want to focus in on. So my suggestion is stop wasting time on water holes. And I say that because I have done that. And I feel like looking in retrospect, that was a major mistake and not worth the benefit. Even though the deer did utilize those, they utilized them at such a minimal rate. And the maintenance and time required and the human intrusion required to have those water resource available for an animal was not worth it. It was not worth it based on the time. So go bigger. Make sure your water's clean. Make sure you have good infrastructure and make sure you have a plan. And that's what I would suggest for anybody who's looking into those particular avenues. And my masterclass, which is coming up here in July, folks will get to see that kind of layout. It's really cool. I guarantee you've not seen anything like this. And I just did the math the other day, 342 properties that I've done up to this point. And I'm actually slowing my workload down for next year. So if you want to get on my schedule, you better get on it because there won't be enough space next year. But on all those properties, I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen anything like this property. I've never seen a layout like this. Now, I've evolved in my layout and design, and I'll talk about that there on my masterclass of how I do design, how I look at things. And a lot of the stuff that I do in a day-to-day, like where I'm working with the client, is completely different than this podcast. the level of sophistication and requirement to get into this design philosophy and having these really cool ideas and functional systems, you know, what we get caught up in is we get caught in this mantra of non-complexity. We look at, I'm going to do edge feathering, or I'm going to plant Milo. There was a guy on the internet, and I can't believe how many people have paid attention to this individual. And I think he does consulting. I would not hire somebody like this, but his whole mentality of Milo, what a Milo serves a great purpose. There's great structure. It's really great for building carbon in the soil. It's a C4 plant. It has its purpose, and it should be laid out in a food plot system for structure, for available food. There's varieties of Milo that I've used in my designs on my own personal property that the deer eat the entire plant. And, you know, one of our objectives is sometimes to use the plant to eventually photosynthesize, to build carbon in the soil. How nice is it in the springtime when you go to disc or plant area, what have you, and you just smell that earth rich soil. And that's a function of high carbon input from a plant. And that's really the purpose of that plant. Yes, there's a food related resource, you know, contingent to that plant. But that's, in my example, that plant is for really fixing soil, and it's a hard plant to crimp. It's not a hard plant to establish, but it serves its purpose, and it's not as nutrient demanding as comparative to another grass like corn. But I also think corn should be, you know, utilized in certain situations. And so I'm not saying don't use different products or don't try things or don't go under the line that, you know, thou shall not. Thou shall, but consider this specific plant and its purpose. And I always, you know, mention that on this podcast, is a plant has a purpose. Allow it to serve its purpose. If it serves a multitude of purposes, one feeding deer, that is a great benefit of that particular plant and something we should consider. But that doesn't mean that we should have in our food plots. I mentioned this on a podcast a couple times ago, and I think MSU Deer Lab is going to be a little bit behind the times when it comes to actually doing these. And again, I mentioned that because I know they're doing these studies, and I've done this for 12 years. You know, look at the types of plants and their interaction, the synergies, and how plants are benefiting other plants. And that companionship aspect doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, plants that deer will actually all consume. And that is a benefit of actually looking at ecology different, looking at plants as resources in the bigger picture, and not looking everything as so deer centric. And that is a major miss, I think, right now in some of the prescription they're doing in their testing. And I only mention that because I think they're doing a great job. I think that's really cool, but there is a miss. And those misses, John Kemp was on this podcast. We mentioned this from some of these other studies where it's often the micronutrients that are driving interest in the plant. And that is a component of actually looking at the full chemical composition of our soil, how functional it is, what the biology is, how well the plant is doing in that situation. And one of the objectives that we typically employ, or I employ with clients, is to make sure they have a smorgasbord. It is a buffet effect type food plot. I want to talk a little bit about food plots today. And I'm going to talk a little bit about micronutrients and nutrients in general. And then I'm going to just hit on compost teas at the end. And that's my objective. We're going to be short on this one. I hope you appreciate this. I'm actually on the road here tomorrow. And then I've got reports to work on. So one of the things I try to do is I typically don't have perennial plots longer than 3 years. And over the past couple of years, I've been lazy. And that's admitting to myself that I don't want to spend time on food plots. And I don't want to spend time on food plots because I'd rather cut timber. I'd rather put in bedding. I'd rather create woody material on the landscape. I would rather do earthworks than food plots. Now, that's totally against the norm. Everybody wants to get on the tractor, and I can do some of that work with tractors, but people want to focus on food plots because it's fun. Things grow. You know, it's nice to see some changes in the landscape, and it's something you feel like you can quote unquote control. But you can't control anything with food plots. In fact, what I've realized over time is once I fix the chemistry or the chemical deficiencies in the food plot, I'm in a much better place to actually manage not just the nutrients, but the plants and the related vegetation in and around those plants and what actually grows in the food plot. But with one contingency, we have these marginal droughty or really heavy rainy seasons, and that just makes everything go to hell. And we had a really wet year the past couple of years, and it's seasonally wet, so it might be wet, you know, spring, and then it we have a dry period and then we have a wet period, but it varies. I have really high organic material, and I did that by going through this nutrient recycling process where I had annuals. I would crimp those. I would sow seed. I didn't have a no-till drill. I didn't really have anything. I got my organic material up to 6.5 to 7%. That's in my area based on soil type. If I could get anything greater than that, and I still think I can, that would be an anomaly, which allows me at that point, once I hit a certain percentage, I'm okay to do a little tillage. And I till, I got my new subsoiler, which I'll show at my habitat day. It's a really special design subsoiler. You really won't see it anywhere else, but what I design it myself. But the cool part about that is I'm able to aerate the soil. I'm able to maintain, I think, the nutrient load correctly in those particular areas. But with those really wet, damp days that we had through those period of time, I got this flush of curly dock. And I don't know if anybody's messed with curly dock, but it is just a pain. And guess what? The deer eat it. All the literature and some of the quote-unquote experts have identified that it's not a consumable by deer. Oh, I've seen them eat it, and they've eaten my entire field full of curly dock. Now, that doesn't mean I want curly dock in there. And one of the things that concerns me with the curly dock is the seed it creates. It produces a bloom of seeds, and it's easily able to take over an entire area. Now, it does serve a purpose. It's got a deep tap root and is great for aeration. So when I looked at that in the landscape, what I decided this year was I'm taking all my plots out of perennials. I'm doing strip plots, and I'm going to keep the clover as a decent percentage in my annual side, and then eventually I'll have a perennial strips in and around those areas. But I'm not there yet. I'll do that in the fall. But I want to take everything out of perennial, and I didn't want to use herbicide. And I got grass, got weed competition, the whole nine. So here was my philosophy. I went in when I thought we'd have a dry spell, and I tilled these particular areas. I have vertical tillage, I've set a disc, and I broadcast seed and I packed it in, and I over-applied maybe 25 to 30% more seed than normal. And I knew in one particular food plot I needed grasses, because what I was having is grasses were developing in those areas. So I've said this multiple times, fight grass with grass. So I employed, you know, a grass in that particular area with about 5 to 6 other species. Knowing full well, chicory, clover, alfalfa is going to probably come back. That was in that area. Now, I do my perennial systems a lot different, and I just established a perennial food plot that I think will blow the previous designs out of the water. I've got a test case here in my backyard, so I got basically about a tenth to a quarter of an acre in the backyard I'll eventually describe how I do that. I'm going to mention it at my master class. So unfortunately, the folks won't be in my backyard. They'll be on my 50 acres, but I'll mention how I... And remind me, if you're going to the masterclass, remind me to bring that topic up so you know what my perennial system works. Because I think it's going to blow the other perennial systems out of the water. And actually, I'm going to start employing grasses in there, perennial grasses in my perennial food plots, which is, again, very unique, but I think there's a benefit to it. That being said, so I dissed these areas and I put this, you know, the seed down. And again, I had curly dock in some of these areas. In one food plot, I had a ton of curly dock. So what I did was I put in a broadleaf that has a similar tap root, which could be a tillage radish or, you know, some type of radish, and could be oilseed radish, but something that replicates what that plant's doing. And if you replicate something like that, that doesn't have a major seed source, now you have more control over this food plot. So I'm fighting annual grasses with perennial grasses, and that works sometimes. And what I noticed, and this has worked out well, I had grasses all in these areas. I had some natural grasses that are kind of wet-loving plants. And then what I did was I overwhelmed the soil with other grass, and it's working. I still have weed competition, but fighting plants with plants in these systems, and I didn't use any herbicide whatsoever. It's not beautiful. It doesn't look perfect. I don't really care. I know that I got to increase some of the biological activity. So right after I did tillage, I put down my effective microbes and I got a new sprayer. So I was looking at different sprayers. I ended up buying a Femco professional sprayer. I have a Honda Pioneer. It's a Honda Pioneer 1000. So you're all, you know, I'm sure everyone has different UTVs, and that particular bed can only handle a 45-gallon sprayer. So I went with the professional sprayer. I've been using these Northstar ones, and eventually they just crap out on you. And, you know, I think it's a better pump. It looks like a better system. I ran it, you know, a bunch of times. It seems like it does quite a bit better. And it's really nice to have at least 45 gallons because when I make my brews, usually they're anywhere between 30, 40, 50, 60 gallons a pop when I'm doing my effective microbes. And what that does is adding biology to the system. And so once you add biology to the system, that helps invigorate and increase microbial activity. And then usually I'll add a little bit of food, which that will be in the next couple of weeks. And I'll do it even in an annual pot where I'll go and I'll spray a bunch of food, quote unquote food in these areas for the microbes, for the plants. And then I'll have this great growth rate. Now, my goal is these annuals will eventually, and I just mowed them the other day. So let me just add a little bit more to the complexity of this equation. So I dissed, I planted, then I had gaps and we had a drought, not a drought, but we had a 2 and 3 week period of no rain so far. I no-tilled into that just before rain. So I added more seed. So I even added more seed in the equation. Then the plants that I didn't want started to produce seed heads right around that time. I went and just mowed them. I mowed them yesterday. I mowed everything right to the ground, almost like a golf course. And so the oats that were coming up, everything's going to come up, will come right back. I had radishes in there. Those will come back. So all these plants will come back. And I've just stalled out the curly dock, some of the grasses that are in there, et cetera. And I'm trying to eliminate the weed competition mechanically. And that was my strategy, and added effective microbes. And I'm going to add some food. And then in 3 weeks from now, I'm going to add micronutrients. And then that'll push the time that these plants go to seed. And then I'll be able to crimp those areas. And before I crimp, I'll just sow in, you know, 20 to 30% extra seed, whatever seed that I'm choosing. And I've already kind of designed my food plots here for the fall. And I pre-brought all my seed. I'm pretty planned out this year. And I'm going to get back into my annual cycle of crops because the objective really is when annual plants, and I can get basically a summer crop, a spring crop, a summer crop, and a fall crop. And if I have annuals in that equation, I'm building biomass. And if I'm building biomass, I'm creating soil activity and nutrient cycling. If that happens, then there's more food for the bacteria, for the worms, and I'm creating the perfect conditions for the soil to kind of take off. What I lack in that equation is compost teas. And this is a big piece of my design, is adding compost teas. I try to do compost teas early in the spring and then late in the fall. So I'm waking up the plant with compost teas and then I'm putting it to bed through the wintertime. And that's good for fungal activity. When you come to my masterclass, you will see I'll actually have my layout. So I basically use an IBC tote. I have two aerators, and then I've got a bunch of material that I add to that equation, and I brew it for about 24 hours. And immediately that 24-hour period, I take that material, I pump it into my big sprayer. I got a big 300-gallon sprayer, and I just sit over those fields and I soak drench them. The other option I have now with my subsoilers, I can actually direct inject the compost teas in the ground. So I've given myself some options where I'm aerating and adding, you know, fertility into that equation. And when you aerate the ground, you are an increased fertility lower in the soil depths. You're absolutely going to increase that annual crop activity, which is going to help increase the overall nutrient cycling, which is going to increase all the chemical composition of your soil at that trophic level or within that rhizosphere. So just consider that when you're coming up with your plan of, okay, what's my crop cycle time? When is it mature? What am I doing? What am I doing for the fall? What am I doing next year? The other thing I'm going to mention, and again, I'm big on food plots right now because I just was mowing them yesterday, is on my other property, my small 20-acre property, I thought I made a major mistake. I thought this was a major folly. So I've been planting like hairy vetch for years and years and years, and I increased the hairy vetch rate in about an acre plot to like 15 pounds more than that. It shouldn't even be anywhere close to that. And I thought it was going to be a complete failure. I have not crimped hairy vetch at that rate, and I just didn't think it was going to work out. And the other thing that seems to happen with vetch is it matures a lot later in the springtime into the summer than rye does, cereal rye. So I was concerned that I didn't have enough rye. I had some wheat in there. The oats died out. So I had crimson clover. I had two or three other plants in there. But I was concerned with the volume of vetch. And it got so tall. And usually when you get height, you get too much weed mat, too much biomass, that I didn't think it would break down fast enough. And it did. this is the beauty of legumes. So I think around, I'm thinking it was about 2 weeks ago, it was to the point where the vetch could be crimped. The rye was past its prime to crimp, and I wasn't exactly sure it would work, but it crimped. And 2 days later, I'll say 2.5, 3 days later, it was brown. All that stuff, all that biomass browned, and I drilled right through it. And I have not gone over and looked at the results because I've been super busy, but I drilled right through it. And I drilled a summer blend, you know, 60, 70 pounds an acre roughly of a summer blend. There's sunflowers in there. There's beans. There's oats. There's just, you know, a plethora of plants in there. There's mung beans. There's just a whole plethora of plants. And, you know, I think it's going to do fantastic. I mean, absolutely fantastic. So I'm super pumped. And you should see, it was amazing to see the deer activity. I mean, there were so many deer in that field. It was impressive. And again, I'm in a low deer population area. And it's just really, really impressive to see all the things that are going on. So one of the recommendations I want to make. So if anybody wants to get into the compost tea business, there's a lot of stuff online. I've been doing it for 5 or 6 years. I don't know exact, but somewhere in that range. I brew everything here at my house. There's some outside material that I buy. I actually have worm bins now, so I'm going to actually start using the vermicompost or the worm poop to do that. But I get my manure from typically a local farmer here. I dig it out of the stalls and I bring it home and I put it basically in a nylon bag. And then I add my additives, whether it's fish hydrolysate, molasses, etc. I create those compost teas. And I tell you, that has been my secret to success. And go online and start doing research on those particular additives and you watch your biology take off. What we lack is in the equation of building soil fertility, we lack a ruminant on the landscape that actually produces a fair amount of output, and in this case, manure. You know, deer are not going to produce the volume of fecal matter to really benefit an area. They do, but just not in a large scale. So without the ruminant, you know, I want quick, fast, effective, soluble nutrients and microorganisms to benefit the soil. And that's the best way to do it. Compost teas are the way to go. And for anybody who's not done anything like this, it is worth the investment. You can buy kits offline. I think there's a company called Tea Lab out in California. You can like buy pre-designed kits. You can find them online. I've actually seen stuff on Marketplace where they have, somebody was doing some brewing and they stopped for farming activity. And again, you can find these. I've made a really cheap, affordable system. I think the total cost of the system in units was probably under $300 for the entire system. And that works great for me. I produce anywhere between, 300 to 500 gallons a year of it. And I spray it with my sprayer. The expense comes in the tractor and the spraying equipment. But you could do, you could do it off your four-wheeler. You could do it off your UTV. You could do it off your lawn tractor. Having a sprayer is an essential. Or you can make a subsoiler, and you could have a subsoiler with some type of water system attached to that, and you can insert, direct inject it in the soil like I'm doing. So that's another option for you and something that I would consider. So I guess I want to end a little bit on, I wrote down a few things that I think are really important. And I think in most instances, a lot of people aren't following these rules. So healthy crops that are resistant to disease, that have more nutrient loads in them, it all boils down to soil biology. And the ecology of the soil is best served when you have a good volume of nutrients that's balanced. And biology will outcompete chemistry any day of the week. And that's why I mentioned these compost teas. It's the soil biology that makes the nutrients available for plants. And plants have that relationship with the microbes that they communicate to one another. And if a plant needs more mineral, it is going to ask in exchange in that rhizosphere, in that root zone, for that mineral. And soil biology is what makes that happen. So as the call goes out for microbes and having the right nutrient availability in and around these plants, which again, that's why you balance the soil, it gives those microbes the ability to manage and support the plants
that are asking for food. That is not anything to do with synthetic fertilizer. In fact, there's no synthetic fertilizer in that equation at all. And what limits microbial activity is really simple: carbon. And carbon in the form of exudates, which is best produced with forbs. We mentioned Milo earlier. The Milo guy, I don't even know what his name is, but the Milo guy, he does consulting. I can't even believe that guy does consult. That just baffles me. But anyhow, the exudates produced, the sugars that are produced, they're sent out through the root system. And that creates a healthy, happy surprise for the microbes. And we want the balance of our soil to have adequate oxygen. Some areas will become anaerobic and aerobic. We want the balance of that. And if the practice in our area is to destroy plants with chemicals, and I see these guys going to big mist sprayers, there's time and place for that, or backpack sprayers. I'm not saying I haven't done it. But what you're doing is you're denuding the environment, and that's a negative outcome. That's we used the word, I think last time, is entropic, entropy. That is destroying and degrading the landscape. So the folks that are big on chemicals, there's a land manager. Again, I see a lot of this stuff on Facebook. There's a land manager that people follow. That's all he talks about is destruction. I just can't get over in my mind that's a priority, destroying the landscape. Other things to consider. So minimizing chemical application, we just mentioned that. Excessive tillage. So you can till once your soil reaches a pretty healthy level. There's good organic material. There's good nutrient cycling. There's a lot of crop residue. And using salt fertilizer is going to set you back. There's a lot of reason why we don't use salt fertilizers, but it's really not a natural state. So I would just ask you to think about these things and realize that there are limitations in the soil. You know, we need calcium for our plants to grow. To build strong, firm fruit, you need calcium. And when there are antagonizers, like in my area, where you have heavy metals and high potassium. In some of your areas, you may have excess sodium. We don't in my particular area, but most of us have low boron. And so there's a synergistic relationship between sulfur and boron and aggressive biology. When you have that, you have better calcium. And the calcium is going to produce a better plant. That is just one cation that is extremely valuable and useful. And so I would just recommend that you start doing a little bit more research. In those that are attending the masterclass, in your packet will be all the different macro and micronutrients and their benefit. You know, we typically employ a little more sodium in our designs. It certainly helps fruits, for example, and you know, especially during the ripening process. But when you increase or create nutrient loads that are of toxic shape, things like salt-based fertilizers, they build up. They build up in those particular areas, and the plants do not function very well. In fact, it actually droughtifies or limits the water content in and around those plants when you're using salt-based fertilizers. Not always, but in many examples, it does. And that's something that I think we need to all pay attention to, is adding something. What does it do? What is it supposed to do? And is it improving or degrading my particular area? Is it something that the plant needs or doesn't it need? And so I would just ask you to just sit and think about, you know, when you're adding something, the benefit to that. There's folks that are adding a lot of calcium chloride, and calcium chloride in high levels is completely toxic. And I can't even think of the name of the product. I don't know if it's Plot Doctor or I don't remember exactly. I don't use any of that stuff. So, but whatever the product is, just look at it and then do some research on it. And is it going to benefit? You need chloride, right? You need calcium and you need chloride. And chloride's really, it's highly mobile in the plant. But when it's a very high count, and usually I see it sometimes probably greater than, you know, your nitrogen levels in and around the plant, your plant is going to be absolutely open to insect, you know, insect susceptibility. Insects are going to seek that plant out because they know it's not healthy. And so one of the issues I have with not using, you know, anything like calcium chloride is Any excess chloride in my system is going to impact already low levels of phosphorus. It antagonizes the phosphorus. So it doesn't even allow the phosphorus to become available. So the calcium chloride is basically negating phosphorus availability. And phosphorus is huge for plant growth, and it's an energy resource. And it limits sulfur in the particular plants. We need sulfur for complete proteins. And so those are the things that I think we miss out on when we're picking a plant, because somebody is selling something and they're selling you some bad advice. So those are some things that I'm thinking about offhand. So I think that's it for today. I will talk to you all next week. I'm on the road this week traveling for clients, and we'll see you again next week.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.